Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is William Wubbenhorst, the co-president of Social Capital Valuations, LLC, a firm dedicated to helping social service programs to estimate their financial impact on program recipients, taxpayers, employers, and medical service providers. They have developed a unique methodology called the Expected Value Return on Investment to measure the success of various social service programs, including many that have a religious flavor to them. Mr. Wubbenhorst has collaborated with professors from several prestigious academic institutions, including Boston University, Baylor, and Harvard, which I believe is a small community college somewhere in rural Massachusetts. He is also a non-resident fellow at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, the fine folks who sponsor our podcast. We invited him on to today's show to discuss one of the programs he recently evaluated, known as Serve West Dallas. And if we have time, we'll also probe some of the other projects he has evaluated or is looking at evaluating. We will link to his firm, as well as the report on Serve West Dallas that he co-authored with Byron Johnson and Sung Jung Jang, both of whom who have appeared on this podcast before. If you are interested in this program or their methods of evaluation, I encourage you to give Baylor's ISR a call and mention that you heard about this on Research on Religion. The contact information will be on our website. William, welcome to Research on Religion.
Glad to be here.
I want to start out today's show by talking about this program that you evaluated called Serve West Dallas. This will help us to get an anchor point to talk about not only that program itself, but what your firm does in terms of its expected value return on investment methodology, which is rather interesting. So start us out by talking first about West Dallas, since many of our listeners might not be familiar with this area, and then we can move on to talk about the SERVE program itself.
Great. Well, West Dallas is an interesting kind of a section of Dallas that's separated by water and otherwise, you know, within the region but somewhat separate. And, you know, it has a history that we've outlined in the case study in terms of, public housing and, you know, low-income residents. And so it's kind of a distinct community within itself. You know, it has a unique history and story, which is kind of tied in with the story of Serve West Dallas itself.
So this is a pretty poor area, and has it been fairly poor for a long period of time?
Yeah, I think, looking at the data in Dallas, there's a couple of fairly distinct areas that are kind of historically low income, including South Dallas as well, but West Dallas at one point had the dubious distinction of having the largest public housing unit in the country. And with that came a host of social and other problems that, you know, became evident with those large public housing approaches back in the 60s and 70s.
And what's the general ethnic composition of West Dallas? Is it African American?
Majority, primarily African American, with a rapidly growing Latino population.
Okay. And about roughly how big is it? I mean, are we talking a small neighborhood, a fairly sizable portion of the Dallas area, or what?
Yeah, in terms of it is its own zip code, roughly. In terms of its overall size, you know, I'm not sure of the particulars, but I think it's 11.5 square mile area, annexed by the city of Dallas in 1952.
Okay. Okay, so we got a poor neighborhood here, and there's a number of different social problems that come with that. And there's this social program called SERVE. Give us an indication of what this program is all about, what's it trying to accomplish, and also a little bit about its history. Where did it come from?
Well, I think we would generally term a place like SERVE West Dallas, you know, in the parlance, excuse me, a faith-based initiative, as a faith-based intermediary. However, there's a story in that itself in which they didn't want to use the term an intermediary. They refer to themselves as a collaborative, and part of that is kind of the dynamics of working collaboratively with organizations that are still, in fact, you know, distinct 501c3s that also raise their own money. So it's really trying to balance kind of the autonomy of these faith-based organizations, and at the same time recognize that, you know, larger problems need collaborative efforts. So I'm a big believer in creative tension. So SERVE West Dallas really kind of walks that line of looking for opportunities to work together, but not wanting to step in and say, you know, you work for us. So that's the balance that they try to strike there.
And so when and where did this thing start? And who started it?
Well, it started through the efforts of Arvel Wilson, who actually grew up in West Dallas, lived in the public housing projects that I referred to before, and really, you know, got out of West Dallas, and at the time said to himself, I'm never coming back, but God had another plan, and after he left the military, he found himself back in West Dallas, and I believe he was saved and called by God to go back and serve within West Dallas. So it's really Arvel Wilson and what he what he felt called to do that kind of sets the tone for everything that Serve West Dallas is, which is it's very collaborative, reaching out to build links between urban and suburban churches. And he is a very selfless person, and the organization kind of mirrors that. They want to get things done. They don't need to get a lot of credit for it.
And what's the time frame that we're talking about here? Is this program created 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago?
I think it was created about 20 years ago. Organizations have been added on. Actually, I take that back. The collaboration had been going on for years, but I think that in particular the formation of Serve West Dallas has only been over the last 10 years or so.
Okay.
A little less than 10 years.
Okay. And you...
In essence, the conversation that led to the formation of the collaborative started about 2007.
Okay. And this is basically working with a number of pre-existing organizations, many of them which are church-based, correct?
Yeah, they are faith-based. Many of them probably were spun off of a church, or, you know, they were the product of a particular mission or ministry of a suburban church that was working in West Dallas.
And is this a particular denominational type of faith-based umbrella organization?
It's pretty much ecumenical.
Mm-hmm.
They serve all and draw from various quarters of the faith community. They all are Christian organizations, though.
Okay, and in the report, you mentioned that SERVE has an inside-out and outside-in approach. What does that mean?
Well, I think the idea, part of what I think the collaboration that Serve West Dallas models is that, you know, there's the story of Arvel Wilson, who came from the community, who came back to the community, started building relationships within the community and with organizations. And then at the same time, you know, he also brought his skills in. In a sense, there were a lot of large suburban churches that, you know, were eager to serve and minister in West Dallas. I think typically they, while well-meaning, they kind of go in with their own agenda and their own specific initiative. And I think, you know, Arvel really helped to kind of almost create kind of a single point or a way that you not only have to coordinate faith-based organizations within West Dallas, but you really need to coordinate the efforts and the resources that are coming from the suburban churches into the community. And I think that dual role that the collaborative has served, I think, is a real unique feature.
And so this involves a number of different projects here, some projects that had been pre-existing for a while and possibly some that have been created recently. You mentioned a couple of these in the report. There is SOAR, Mercy Street Mentoring, ACT, and Brother Bill's Helping Hand Clinic. Go through each one of these specifically, because these are the things that you'll be evaluating with your research methodology. Let's go ahead and start with SOAR. What is SOAR?
Well, SOAR is what I would say truly a collaborative. The efforts in SOAR, which is essentially a partnership with an elementary school in West Dallas, and it brings to bear, I think, five or six of the members, the ministry partners within the collaborative, each doing a certain thing. So you have Mercy Street, which is a mentoring organization that is matching mentors with some kids. You have ARC, Adults Relating to Kids, who's instituting various types of trainings for teachers and engaging parents. So it's truly a kind of a single-site collaborative effort. So in that respect, it kind of represents the first truly integrated collaborative within the program. And then the other three that you mentioned, basically just highlighting three of the partners. We actually do a profile and an ROI analysis for, you know, almost all of the ministry partners. We just featured Mercy Street, ACT, and Brother Bill's, but the other organizations are described and analysis is provided in the appendix.
So what is, you give us an idea what SOAR is. They're working with one elementary school or a number of elementary schools?
Well, they started with Amelia Earhart Elementary School. They are now, I think, expanding to, I think it's George Washington Carver Elementary School. And it's meant to be a complete kind of holistic wraparound. You know, it's a highly collaborative model with the school, which in and of itself is a rarity. And essentially, they set a goal for themselves. The specific academic focus was to improve reading scores. And the data that I was able to show certainly supported, you know, they had fantastic results. The school was in a at-risk designation. I don't remember the specific term, but essentially the tracking the reading level scores, you know, showed significant improvements in terms of the percentage of kids that were at reading level in the school. So in essence, and I had written a case study previous to this, right at the point that the SOAR program was starting. So it was very exciting for me to come back with this follow-up case study and basically, you know, able to track the, at the time that SOAR started, only 17% of the students in the I think they did grades 2 through 5, were at grade level when the SOAR program started. And then by spring of 2014, that had increased to 40%. So, you know, a huge impact. And like I said, by virtue of those improved scores, the school itself was taken off of the watch list, if you will, for the Dallas School District. So, you know, very encouraging in terms of the improvements that happened.
So you had an opportunity to visit this place. You said you were there when they were just starting off the program, trying to get kids to read better, and then came back a little bit later, and that the SOAR program also involves a number of different components. What does it look like on the day-to-day basis, that if I stop by Amelia Earhart School and I say, you know, my kid's got to be in the SOAR program, how is that working? Do adults come in after school, read books to the kids? Are there incentive programs that if you read so many books and pass a test, you get a skateboard? Or how does this thing actually operate?
Well, it's a full range. I mean, first of all, you and again, this is a great model for the outside-in component. You have basically there's a church where you know, and they have small group fellowships there. Each small group was paired up with a teacher and a class, and ostensibly their goal was to help that teacher with whatever they need. If it meant bringing in cupcakes, they'd bring in cupcakes, just to really come alongside of the teacher and to help support and foster, you know, whatever helps you need, everything, you know, basically from cupcakes to tutoring. But then you also, you know, in essence, and we're starting to break this down, and future analysis will be more specific. Any given student, because the program is so comprehensive, every student is touched in one way or the other. Now, not every student has a mentor. Not every student participates in the after-school sports program, which is sponsored by Voices of Hope. But ultimately, in one way or another, you know, they're touching every student. And what we'll do in the future is to analyze that more closely and to see if particular interventions, you know, mentoring versus, you know, the ARC training of teachers or parental involvement, you know, so we know there are good results. What we haven't done is to kind of go underneath the hood and to analyze the particulars. So there's a vast array of programs and initiatives, and all of the students, some are being touched, you know, several times, some maybe just touched once. So there's a lot more for us to unpack there.
Now, you mentioned cupcakes, and I would imagine that that is one of the things that you would have to evaluate in your program. So did you evaluate them on taste, how good they were? Did you have to do multiple samples? Because, you know, one cupcake isn't enough.
We're breaking down the outcomes associated with chocolate icing versus vanilla icing.
Yeah. I would volunteer to help you measure that.
The impact on the reading scores will be.
Yeah, I would volunteer to help you measure that. I would eat the cupcakes. I love cupcakes.
Yeah.
But
well, you know, then we also have to, we want to combat childhood obesity, so there's a limit to the cupcakes as well.
Oh, well, I would eat them all. I would throw myself on the cupcakes for the kids. That's what I would do. One of the curious thing that just popped into my head, I'm assuming that Amelia Earhart School is a public school. And you have here some small groups from various churches and suburban areas or the local areas coming in to work with teachers. I mean, I know this is Texas, but does this create any kind of church-state conflict? Has anybody raised a red flag by saying, whoa, what are these church organizations doing here in this public school?
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a real lack of understanding. There's a certain stereotype that you know, what Christians do is hand out tracts. But all of this, and I've seen this throughout Dallas, and that's why I always enjoy coming there, that, you know, this is servant missionary. In other words, whatever witness that may occur is nothing specific and deliberate. It's simply people are there to serve, and there is no kind of indoctrination or tract. You know, obviously that's clearly inappropriate, and nothing of that sort happens. But people are witnessing the love of Christ in providing this service, and that's it. So there is nothing in the way of promoting religion. in any way, shape, or form. These are simply people that are motivated to serve, and Serve West Dallas through SOAR helps them to do that in a more specific, focused, and integrated way than if they just kind of walked into West Dallas and tried to make themselves useful.
You know, that's pretty impressive. That I'm sure the parents are pretty happy that this is going on if they see reading scores improving and their kids doing better. So probably no reason to complain. But I would know in some parts of the country, possibly out here in the Pacific Northwest, if you had a church group coming and helping with reading programs, even if they're not passing out.
I did a lot of work in the faith-based initiative in the Bush administration. And similarly, within the Beltway, there was just a complete lack of understanding of what really takes place when faith-based organizations collaborate with schools and public agencies. And it's very unfortunate because so much more could be done with just a better understanding of what actually takes place and a better understanding of the, you know, kind of the servant mission approach. You know, so that it's a big area where there needs to be more education and awareness, for sure.
Tell us about Mercy Street Mentoring. Is that a similar program to SOAR? Is it work with SOAR? What's Mercy Street?
Mercy Street is a participant in SOAR.
Okay.
But they are about mentoring. And, you know, a lot of the research, you know, what you tend to see in terms of charities in very broad terms are what I would call commodity-based ministries, and you have relationship-based ministries. Commodity-based ministries are food banks, place to get clothing. You know, commodities are the primary exchange. In relationship, you're talking about people making the choice to become a part of somebody else's life, and that, you know, Mercy Street represents that very well. And so, they are mentoring kids all the way from, I think it's about grades 5 to 12.
Okay.
I'm sorry, fourth grade and can go all the way up to 12. And, you know, some of those mentors continue for 8 years. Some may continue for 2 years. But that's what they do. That's what they are. They also do some after-school sports programs as well, but we were focusing specifically on the mentoring program.
And is this mentoring academic mentoring, you need some help with math, kid, here I can help tutor you, or is it more general life skills as well, saying,
These are general life skills. Okay. There are, the small groups from the suburban churches I spoke to, some of them may be coming in and doing tutoring, but my understanding is Mercy Street is primarily about life skills. It's not to say that in the process of interacting with a kid, you know, there may be some of that, but it's mostly for life skills, I think.
Okay, so you meet the kid after school and say, hey, let's head out to the park and throw the football around and talk about things that are going on, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The premise here is, and this is an area of research that we're just delving into, and it's becoming very evident in the literature, is as important as grades are, social and emotional learning is probably a more significant indicator of future success. And obviously something like mentoring is getting right at social emotional learning, which is really, you know, what we might call about being mature or being age appropriate in your behaviors and actions, and not simply how you score in a test.
Okay, that's an interesting approach. I like that. And are there any cupcakes involved in this?
Yeah, no cupcakes.
Okay, I'm very focused on the cupcake thing. Once you mentioned that, my ears perked up. What about ACT? That's one of the other of the four programs underneath the umbrella of SERVE that you mentioned. So, what is ACT?
Yeah, and ACT, you know, another example of, what I've found, ACT was started by a lawyer, and a lawyer who wanted to serve and was called to use his skill set. And that skill set had a lot to do with, you know, using the law and using legal action. In this specific context, ACT is about trying to take either abandoned houses or houses that are being rented to drug dealers and, you know, getting them out of there or shutting down the building or getting it knocked down or whatever. And there's a lot of evidence that even though people act like it's squeezing a balloon, there's a lot of evidence that if you address these properties, there's a lot of bad things that happen in the properties, in connection with the properties, and it's a very effective strategy for reducing crime and improving safety in a community. And so what we did is, we can talk about the ROI piece at some point. We looked at the cost of crime. We looked at the impact of crime on property values, and were able to track improvements in those areas as a result of closing down in this particular, these two neighborhoods that we were studying.
Okay. So we'll put that one on the back burner and hold off on the results for a while. That keeps people listening mm-hmm. to the show. The last one here that you have as a case study, and you evaluated more of these, but the report that you published with Baylor's ISR covers these four things: SOAR, Mercy Street Mentoring Act, and then Brother Bill's Helping Hand Clinic. Now, there's got to be cupcakes involved in this one. What's Brother Bill all about?
Well, specifically, no, because they're diabetes is one of the health issues that they are focused on. So fresh fruit, maybe.
Okay.
But, you know, Brother Bill is one of my favorites simply because I have a background as a healthcare consultant. I'm also tracking changes in healthcare through reform, and there's this move towards what's called population health, which is basically focused on, you know, how do we improve people's health instead of spending all our money on trying to fix them after they get sick? So Brother Bill does a lot of things. It's kind of your classic community-based organization. What they do there that is particularly interesting is they've got clinicians coming in measuring, you know, A1C levels, which is a determinant of diabetes, hypertension. So they're tracking actual, you know, health data on people coming in. But they also provide exercise classes. They also provide health and nutrition classes. And they also have a grocery giveaway. And the genius of the Brother Bill's Helping Hand is, the fancy term for it is behavioral economics. In simple terms, Brother Bill says, if you want to participate in our grocery program, someone in your family needs to attend at least one health class. So from a research standpoint, it's ideal because not only can we track who took what classes, but we know their A1C blood levels, we know their hypertension, so and it's very easy to project savings in health costs associated with whether somebody is managing their hypertension or their diabetes well. So that was one of my favorites.
Now, all of these things, SOAR, Mercy Street Mentoring Act, and Brother Bill's Helping Hand Clinic. Actually, I have to ask a question. Is Brother Bill's Helping Hand Clinic in a bricks and mortar building? Does it have several locations? Or I kind of imagine this thing is like in a big van driving around to different blocks.
It is bricks and mortar.
Okay.
You know, so they have... And they have numerous other programs there that, because they weren't relevant to health, we weren't looking at them. But, you know, they do Thanksgiving baskets, and they have programs for kids and all sorts of things. And that's part of the beauty of it, that they've kind of folded all of these things into one location.
Okay. Very cool. Now, back to my question about SERVE. One of the things that you mentioned in the report is that SERVE acts as an umbrella way to collaborate or to coordinate all these things. And you mentioned that this is different from the old silo model of faith-based organizations helping communities. and it represents a new collaborative model. Explain the difference between those two and what Service is doing with this new collaborative model.
Well, you know, for me, I had done some research previously on, I was doing work with Department of Labor and looking at career centers, and we did it. We literally did a survey of African American churches in Memphis on various levels. Now, what we discovered, which wasn't surprising, is they were not familiar with what are called one-stop career centers, which is where people go to look for jobs and get training. But what was also significant was their lack of awareness of what other churches were doing in this area. So I think similar to in Serve West Dallas, there is a tendency, again, these are well-intended programs, but they focus in on their population and their program. And what's lost there is the complexity of challenges in low-income neighborhoods, and that you can't simply address one issue with a particular family or individual and expect success. And I think the SOAR program is a perfect example of that. And I think likewise, funders, and I reference a study by that was published in the Stanford Innovation. You know, funders are starting to realize that they're a bit piecemeal in how they give out their money. So I think we're in a transition. I do believe that projects like SOAR, these integrated collaborations, are going to become more of the norm. I think they're going to be more attractive to funders. And I think in many respects, they are a more effective solution because they are trying to address all of the factors that are associated with, you know, low-income people and improving academic success, improving life success. So I think that's really... We're in a transition period because Serve West Dallas needs to be very sensitive to the unique history of each organization, but hopefully these organizations will likely see that they may get more and more funding as part of a collaborative than they will get standalone funding.
And that brings me to my next question about how Serve does fund itself. Is it getting donations from private volunteers? Is it applying for government grants via the faith-based initiative program? Where's the cash coming from?
Yeah, they're getting, I think they're getting, you know, foundation funding. They don't, you know, there's no membership fee or anything on the ministry partners. So, and it, you know, it's a delicate thing because they will at times, you know, seek funding from foundations that may also be funding one or more of the ministry partners. And so that's a, you know, that's obviously a very sensitive issue. The other challenge that intermediaries and collaboratives like Serve West Dallas have is it's difficult to get funders to understand how important the role of a intermediary collaborative is. It's not, you know, for lack of a better term, it's not sexy. You know, you don't necessarily have the stories about, you know, directly reaching out to this or that child or this or that family. But at the end of the day, what we're trying to do in the case study and in the analysis and in the ROI is to say, let's focus on results. So it is challenging for Serve West Dallas to raise money, but they need to do it. And, you know, we need to start evaluating programs based on results and not these kind of arbitrary measures of, you know, what percentage goes to admin, what percentage goes to program. Because you can have 99% going into a program, but if the program's not effective, you're no better off.
Right. In terms of the distribution of funds that Serve gets, how do they decide that? And is there some territorial conflicts here that, do some of these pre-existing organizations feel that with Serve coming in, they're sucking some of the air or some of the money out of the room? And has there been any tensions, or has it been pretty smooth sailing?
I think at the onset, there were some people in Serve West Dallas that were not sensitive to that dynamic, and it produced some challenges. It varies. For ministry partners, some of the stronger, more established ones, you know, you need to be a little bit more. Some of the smaller ones that have difficulty getting money on their own, you know, maybe more enthusiastic in embracing the Sir West Dallas Collaborative. So, you know, I think it tends to vary. I know that Scott Hansen, who heads up Sir West Dallas, and Arvo Wilson are very patient, very diligent, you know, very selfless in the work that they do. But, you know, at the same time, you know, yes, there is some attention that can and should go to Sir West Dallas, because none of these organizations had the ability to orchestrate, you know, a collaborative like SOAR. SOAR and the work that comes from SOAR wouldn't exist if not for Sir West Dallas. Mm-hmm.
So let's evaluate these things right now. And I am curious about the evaluators. That's you, because as I do more and more of these podcasts, I find out there's all these different small niche industries that are serving churches. We think of the religious landscape as just being churches and pews and a priest or something like that. But there's all these different support networks, and we've talked about, you know, different groups that help with the successions of pastors from one pastor to another, with conflicts within a church. There's a whole group of businesses that actually deal with that kind of stuff. And yours is rather interesting that you are in a partnership with Andrew Gluck, and you go around and basically evaluate some of these faith-based programs and give people feedback. Yes, this is working. That's not working. Tell me a little bit about your personal background and how you founded your business.
Well, I think it really started. I have to give credit to my my wife. She was not then my wife, but I was working in a community-based organization, you know, lifting boxes, doing a lot of food ministries, and she suggested I go to business school. And, you know, I laughed at the thought at first. I gave it more thought and ended up going to, I got an MBA with a concentration in public and nonprofit management, which is truly an oxymoron, because I'm sitting alongside of people essentially. The whole curriculum of an MBA is centered on a bottom line, and I choose to concentrate in organizations that don't have a bottom line. So, you know, since getting my MBA, you know, I've had a wide variety of experience working in state government, working as a consultant to federal agencies, healthcare systems, nonprofits, a whole range of things. And, you know, it's just it kind of is coming full circle, and my colleague Andy Gluck likewise has an MBA, and so really what it is to take what we think is good and helpful in the private sector and find a way to blend it with the world of charity and public agencies in a thoughtful way, but you know, the implications of what we're asking these organizations to do is significant, in the sense that we're saying to them, you need to understand, measure, and manage based on your outcomes. So in that sense, it is definitely revolutionary. You know, it's something I'm passionate about, and, you know, something I just give, you know, I give glory to God that all of these things, all of my experiences kind of came together in the formation of the business and, you know, the innovation that is the, you know, the expected value return on investment methodology.
So how did this business all start out? I'm also very interested in the origins of a lot of organizations. You probably were hanging around with Andy Gluck and said, hey, you doing anything
well,
next
Andy
week?
Andy and I were both employed originally in a company called Macro International, and it's, you know, it's near the Beltway. Most of its money was federal contracts work. And then I had the benefit when I was a number of years prior to that, I read a book called The Tragedy of American Compassion by Marvin Alasky. And it helped answer the question to me is like, I see all these references in the Bible about serving people, but it looks like government does most of that. What happened? And so I learned about that. And, you know, I just felt the calling on my life to be what I would call a kingdom consultant and doing kingdom policy. And lo and behold, when the Bush administration inaugurated the Faith, Based, and Community Initiative, I was fortunate enough to be involved in a number of those initiatives, which kind of exposed me to the world of faith-based organizations and collaborations and intermediaries. And that's how I met up with Byron Johnson, who I've worked with for the past 15 years or so. So really it was, you know, seeing organizations, and I did a lot of site visits, and I would see organizations on the ground, and, you know, you just know when you see a good organization and they're doing things right. But you also know that in order to communicate that to a broader audience, there has to be data and outcomes. And so it would really break my heart to see what I knew was an effective program, but they had no data infrastructure. So, you know, unless you go and visit them, you don't know how good they are. And, you know, combine that with the fact that, you know, the process by which government grants are issued seem to be more a function of how good a grant writer you have than how good your program is.
Yeah.
So really, all of those kind of work together to say, you know, my own personal motivation is, and a lot of the organizations I saw were faith-based organizations, and frustrated at the fact that what I could tell was a clearly effective organization couldn't represent that uniqueness in the grant process. I mean, if you're a businessman, you want to put your money where results are happening. But there's simply no system in the millions and billions of grant dollars that are put out there. There's no, you know, objective or semi-objective method to evaluate that. And we have a long way to go, but there's no replacement for that. And so that's my crusade is, not for faith-based organizations. My crusade is for effective organizations. And, you know, related to my passion of that is I think taxpayer dollars are sacrosanct, and it annoys me to no end to see how they're wasted on programs that are not accountable and, you know, programs that can attract funds that really can't demonstrate any outcomes.
Amen to that.
So
that brings me to your methodological tool here that you promote on your website, which is the expected value return on investment. Specifically, what is that? And, you know, you don't have to go into the, you know, trade secret algorithms to any of this, but give us an idea of how you actually measure these different programs. And also, how do you find clients to do this? I mean, I can imagine some organizations would be like, oh, you're coming in and evaluating. If you give us a bad report, we're going to lose funding. I mean, I'm just wondering how you actually connect with some of your clients, too.
Well, I think, I mean, it, just briefly, the origin, if you will, of what we now call EVROI was actually we were providing technical assistance to grantees that were receiving money from the Responsible Fatherhood Program. And what's important to recognize is that this methodology was not we were not doing evaluation. We were there to help the grantees. And one thing that grantees are very concerned about is sustainability. And so it's important to recognize that we do evaluations and we know the evaluation world, but EVROI did not come out of the evaluation world. It came out of helping organizations become sustainable. And the reason that that's important is simply because what we have developed, and most of our clients are practitioners. I think we want to expand this work to funders, but we are concerned about the dynamic that you just described. Mm-hmm. that being perceived as coming in from the outside and, you know, evaluating an organization, I think it would be useful, and we're looking to grow there. But the reality is, most of our clients are practitioners and providers, and they are obviously practitioners and providers that aren't afraid to go down this path to find out what they're really accomplishing. So I think that really the issue comes to what we've developed. A lot of ROI methodologies do come out of the evaluation community. They are intellectually appealing and pragmatically unimplementable, if that's a word. And so in our program, ours is very practitioner-friendly. And when we engage the practitioner, we want to talk to the frontline people, whoever's in interacting with your client. And we start with very simple questions, which is, what does success look like? Mm-hmm. Describe success. And in the process of learning that, we begin to identify things that we think we can measure and things that we think we can project a cost value on. So that's really, we really say that we built this from the bottoms up in a way that practitioners can understand, because at the end of the day, once they see, we don't have to tell them to manage their program differently. Once they see the value of EVROI, they are intrinsically motivated to rethink how they manage their programs. So that's really the distinctive nature of EVROI. It was built for sustainability, and it's practitioner friendly.
And it's interesting how you mentioned that you talk to the frontline people and ask them, what does success look like, and then start thinking about measures, because it must be fairly difficult to find some measures for some of these things. I'm thinking of our earlier discussion about the emotional and social learning that teenagers go through. That's got to be pretty hard to measure. How do you figure out success in that realm?
I think this might distinguish us as MBAs versus PhDs. A PhD doing a certain evaluation will say, well, if you want to find out, you know, X, Y, Z, you know, you need data on A, B, C. Well, the reality is that we work with clients to improve their data collection, but we don't say, you know, collect this data and I'll see you in a year. We are fully prepared and to provide them with what we would call a first-generation EVROI analysis. And the reason we call it that is sometimes we may have as little as how many people you served, what your curriculum is, or what your intervention is, and what your annual budget is. And, you know, on that little information, we are prepared to make what we call a projection. And that projection includes a lot of assumptions. And we think we are very conservative in our assumptions. But at the end of the day, we're going to come up with a value, because we feel as though an organization that is saying nothing is the equivalent of an organization that is doing nothing. And we think that our estimates are a closer approximation to the reality of what they're accomplishing than nothing. So from our standpoint, you know, even though an evaluator at times, you know, they might look at our analysis and say, you can't say that. And our reply is, well, we can say anything. We're going to footnote our assumptions, and we're going to, you know, we might attribute outcomes from a similar program, and we'll document all that. But we will say something, and we want people to come back and challenge us, because that's just going to strengthen our methodology.
Mm-hmm. And so I would imagine that you provide what you call your first generation, but there's second generation and third generation ROIs where you come back with modified information based upon what you find initially, right?
Yeah, and that's why what we do not want to come in, you know, put an EVROI analysis and go away. Our business model is predicated on people that want to make this a way of life and really want to make the commitment. Because at the end of the day, they have to commit more resources to data collection, period. And they have to get out of this mentality, although I understand it, so, I'm taking food out of the mouth of babes to pay for a data collection system. You know, that perspective simply doesn't see the big picture. Because if you don't make that commitment, and with the growing demands of funders, you're not going to have resources to feed anyone. So, that's the key, I think, is for them to understand the world that we're in, the accountability that's being demanded, and to see that and make this commitment.
Let's finish off here by talking about what you found with Serve West Dallas. You already gave us a few hints that the SOAR program and trying to improve literacy rates and reading comprehension has done a really good job, but give us the top line analysis. I'm going to point folks back to the report, and again, you can get this at Baylor's Institute for Study of Religion. It's a wonderful glossy report that has a lot of figures and data and charts and all that kind of stuff in there, but that's really good for people reading it. It doesn't translate very good into audio, so just give us the top line of what you found with the Serve West Dallas program.
Well, what we chose to do, the outcomes that we got on SOAR, the ability to get the data was a breakthrough in and of itself, because it's essentially a partnership through SMU and the Dallas School District that we were able to get the data to track the reading scores. So that was a victory. We did not do an ROI analysis on the SOAR program, primarily because we don't have good data yet on social and emotional learning. There are survey instruments out there, so we made a decision that we showed the outcomes, which were very positive, but we did not do an ROI on the SOAR program. We hope to do that in future iterations. The Mercy Street is perhaps one of the most challenging ones if you think about, how do you demonstrate the return on investment for mentoring? And we relied on some research out of the Brookings Institution, which identifies various markers for success in different life stages. We also had data from the school system, we were able to match test scores for students that were being mentored at Mercy Street, not just at Amelia Earhart, but across the state. Across the city. So, the long and short of it is the goal here is to, we call it achieving middle class. But in reality, when you're trying to measure the benefits, we often find ourselves measuring the absence of a negative. And by that I mean greater success in school is associated with fewer teen pregnancies. It is associated with a higher likelihood of graduating high school, going to college, and future earnings. And that would be a pro-social outcome, the academic one. And essentially what you're trying to do is to make two projections. One projection is absent the program, such as Mercy Street, and the other one is with the program. And to begin to look at additional, for example, if somebody earns more income because they went to college, well, that translates into more income tax revenue. So we don't actually capture the benefits to the actual individual being served. We're trying to capture the societal benefits. So for Mercy Street, really our methodology was about projecting. We were able to show improvements in reading and math scores, which is an important indicator for high school graduation, and then from there to project better high school graduation, better lifetime earnings, fewer teen pregnancies, and fewer criminal involvement. And those all kind of folded into the projections that we did there. For the ACT program, that was a completely different animal. We were tracking changes in property values in the neighborhood where ACT was working and comparing that to West Dallas as a whole. We were also looking at reduced crime rates, which we were able to discover, and considering the cost of crime. And so the argument there was simply that the property value improvement and the reduced crime, you know, produced savings that were well in excess of the cost of the ACT program. And we describe our findings in practitioner-friendly terms, which is for every dollar spent on the program, how many dollars of savings occur. So for the ACT program, I think that was we were able to project $5.79 in savings for every dollar invested in the program.
That's a great return.
Yeah, so that's
almost like sixfold return.
Yeah, in the private sector, you're happy with a 20% ROI, and we're talking about an ROI of 500%.
Yeah, almost 600%. $5.79 on the dollar. That's great.
Yeah. And then for Brother Bill's Helping Hand, we were focusing on a couple of chronic conditions, hypertension and diabetes. And, you know, again, this is all preliminary information. This is not going to show up in a peer-reviewed journal anytime. But again, we made, I think, conservative assumptions. We footnoted all of the articles from which we get our cost information, and basically made the argument that, their reduced hospitalization costs, reduced health costs, based on the improvements that we were able to track in the people that were participating in the health clinic at Brother Bill's Helping Hand.
And are people getting healthier out there?
Yes.
Awesome.
One of the things, personally that kind of shocked me and continues to shock me is the epidemic nature of diabetes. It is unbelievable. We found 40% of the participants at Brother Bill's Helping Hand diagnosed with diabetes. So we're not necessarily curing diabetes, but they are, if they can get their A1C levels down, they can manage their condition. But it is absolutely horrendous. It is probably the most least understood, and its prevalence, the whole diabetes obesity thing is, shocking. And so we wanted to shine a light on it in terms of programs that were taking practical steps to try to address that. And it's a very complicated issue. You can imagine it's tied in with culture and diet and, emotional and cupcakes and all of that.
Yeah.
But it was, the Brother Bill's Helping Hand, they also did some flu vaccinations, which we think have a positive cost benefit. And, roll those up, and we found that savings of, $6.64 for every dollar invested in the health clinic.
Wow. That's even better than ACT.
Well, we do discourage, at this early stage of the process, we discourage comparisons of that sort. The broader message is we're seeing positive returns in these programs. But, the assumptions and the variables are so distinct that even though they both have dollar signs, we do discourage those comparisons.
But what we're both saying is that they are really good programs that are showing some good return on investments, and We should keep them rolling out there and possibly in some other places as well. And that brings me to my last question, is that you've had the opportunity to visit SOAR a couple times and work with the folks at Serve West Dallas and over the several years that you've been evaluating them. What's your big takeaway? Are you really enthusiastic about this type of collaborative program? Do you see it expanding in other cities? And what do you think will motivate people to take a look at something like this and say, hey, this is the model of the future. Let's use this.
I think there's a lot of indications of movement in this direction. I think that the challenge with these collaborative efforts is if you don't have the collaborative efforts we're seeing now are coming with a very rigorous data component, which you have to have, because otherwise the nonprofit and the public sector, you know, often get into these situations where they collaborate for the sake of collaborating. Well, the purpose is to collaborate with a specific measurable objective and an outcome, and to be able to measure the success of the collaborative based on those outcomes. And without that, then, you know, you're just spinning your wheels. You know, I do think Serve West Dallas is an effective model for the future. But I have to continue to harp both on the ministry partners and Serve West Dallas on beefing up their data infrastructure. I think that's the big challenge. I think the EVROI results, some of the organizations have absolutely taken up the banner and making the commitments. Brother Bill's Helping Hand and ACT, one of the reasons I could feature them is because of their commitment to this. But that has to happen, and we have to dispel the notion that, you know, we're taking service dollars and putting them into admin, because it's going to be an essential component to being able to communicate your program. And, you know, the question you asked before, you know, how do we find the client? I think we're under-marketed. I need to do a better job. Most of the clients come out of relationships and networking. You know, I rarely come across somebody that I talk to this about that aren't excited. It's just we're looking at things like distance learning. We're looking to develop an online curriculum so that we can reach more people with, you know, what we're doing and how to do it.
Yeah, and I saw from your website, too, and we'll point people back to your website, that you're involved in a number of other projects evaluating prison ministries, which is big on Baylor Johnson's agenda. He's a great scholar there, and a bunch of other things. And unfortunately, we don't have time to dip into all these, so we're going to have you back at some point in time to discuss some of these other projects and see how they're coming along. But William Wobenhorst, I've been absolutely delighted to have you on the program today. Thanks for being on Research on Religion.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.